Hello, East Coast.
Hello. Hello, West Coast.
How are we?
Hey, Broadway, you want to calm down there?
No. Sorry. I had an afternoon of being serenaded while I was trying to work with the other half singing, "We Gotta Have Heart."
We gotta have heart.
Yeah, exactly. Now it's stuck in
miles
my head.
Miles and miles and miles of heart. One more?
No.
No, we didn't want any.
What are we doing tonight? What's the story? What are we doing?
This is a one show, one drinker, I believe.
It is.
It certainly is.
It is, right? All right. Well, I have an intro for this. Should I do the intro now or should I do it after the music?
No, after
okay.
The music.
All right. Yeah, we got a one show, one drink episode tonight. So it's a shorty. It's a shorty. You ready for it?
I think so.
Let's roll the intro.
I'm going to roll the intro?
Yeah, run the intro.
All right, I'll run the intro. Let's cut the nonsense out. Let's get right to it. Let's get right to it, right?
Welcome to One Show, One Drink, part of the What We Watch When We Drink podcast from the Booze Dancing Entertainment Network, where we take one show or film and pair it with one boozy beverage. If you enjoy this show, please subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, Google, Audible, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. You can also find us on boozedancing.com, and if you have any questions, comments, show, or drink suggestions, email us at boozedancing@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
I always like to see the intro because we get to see our list of future sponsors. It's nice.
That's right.
Future? The future is now. You know who our next sponsor is going to be? Jazzercise.
Jazzercise. We could get Jazzercise. They're very popular right now. Isn't it 1987, Dan?
It is in my mind. I wish it was 1987. I'd be 20 years old.
There you go. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Booze Dancing Entertainment Network. You might know us from Booze Reviews at the Murder Table, Holly Weird Polygons, Hey, Does That Look Infected? And of course, this little beauty, One Show, One Drink.
Which is part of
the Booze Dancing Entertainment Network, which is also part of What We Watch When We Drink.
There you go.
And tonight, our one show is
After Hours.
After Hours, he said. A 1985 Martin Scorsese flick.
My boy Marty.
Marty Scorsese, your buddy, part of your tribe. I do remember seeing this one. I remember seeing it with my friend Andy, I believe, in a theater.
I believe. Yes.
Yes, in a theater. Because they didn't have the streaming then, I believe.
They had VHS.
They had beta too as well. Don't forget. So that is our one show or one movie. And what is our one drink?
You were kind enough to send us samples. And one of the samples you sent is an Ailsa Bay Sweet and Smoke 1.2 Travel Retail Edition that clocks in at 48.9% ABV.
This is a single malt scotch from the Lowlands, kind of a newer distillery. Mike, you said it was owned by William Grant, I believe, earlier.
I believe it comes as a William Grant, yeah.
Part of the William Grant families.
They're the fine folks that bring us Glenfiddich and Balvenie, and what else do they have? They have a bunch of stuff. Hendrick's Gin.
I came across this bottle last year, traveling from Italy post-COVID in Venice, and went to World of Whiskey or whatever that duty-free store is in Terminal 5, I think. And I saw this and I said, hey, give this one a shot.
Do you want me to read a little bit here?
Yeah,
sure.
Let's tell the people what it's about.
There's not a whole lot on the website. It says scientifically distilled at 0.22 parts peat and 0.19 parts sweet, then micro-matured to a precise balance of oaky sweetness and smoky notes. This award-winning new age single malt pushes the boundaries of flavor. We know about the PPM. Well, we know about the PPM, but our listeners may not. But then there's also the SPPM.
Yeah.
So it says here, the PPM is the precise measurement of the phenol content in parts per million. The higher the phenol levels, the more peaty the whiskey will taste. Ailsa Bay contains 0.22 PPM, which is assessed prior to bottling, guaranteeing a more accurate measurement. But then there is SPPM, which I've never heard of. So Ailsa Bay is the first whiskey to have an analyzed measurement of sweetness identified. This is possible through a revolutionary process defined by master blender Brian Kinsman. The whiskey is defined as having 0.19 SPPM within it, which gives it the perfect balance between the peat and sweetness.
So I've never seen that before.
Nope, me neither.
A sweetness number as well as a peat number. And you don't also see, which is interesting too, the peat level measured where they measure it. They measure it after, not before.
Shall we do a little cheers?
Yeah, I think we should do a little cheers.
Let me get All right, gents. Well, here's to new whiskey.
To new whiskey.
All right. There you go.
We'll sync that up in editing.
No. That's right. No, we won't. We never do.
They also pride themselves on doing what was the other thing you mentioned?
Micro maturation, which I've never heard before. They're using, Elsa Bay is also the only Scotch whiskey to undergo a process called micro maturation. The distillery's new make spirit is first filled into Hudson Baby bourbon casks that are between 25 and 100 liters in size for 6 to 9 months. The relatively small casks, traditional American oak barrels, can contain up to 200 liters of spirit. Enables intense, rapid maturation. The liquid is then transferred into virgin first fill and refill American oak casks for several years. The process is the first of its kind within the Scotch whiskey industry. Interesting.
What do you think?
I like the nose.
Yeah.
The nose is kind of cool. And you know, maybe it's all the gobbledygook we just read, but I do get the sweet and the peat. I get like a baked apple and like light smokiness to it. A
little bit of barbecue. Like a good rib sauce. That's what I'm getting.
Whoa.
It's a lot hotter than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, it's got some, it's building.
And it throws in the smoke and the sweetness, but they don't talk about the pepper. There's a lot of pepper in that.
No. But you know what? It almost has like a chili, like a poblano or like a light chili. You know, I'm not going to say it's like a cayenne, but it has almost like a.
It's nice.
You know,
nice.
Poblano or maybe a Serrano chili. Like slightly roasted.
Yeah, there's a little heat there. And I think Mike was right on the barbecue thing. There's a little bit of barbecue smoke, not just peat smoke. Well, why don't we come back for a second drink for that once we talk a little bit about after hours.
I will say first impressions are very strong. I like it.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's delicious.
And as delicious. I recall, very reasonably priced, not very expensive in
travel retail.
Right? At travel retail, okay. Right? I don't think it's a travel retail special. I think it's just
that's where you happen to get it.
That's where I happen to get it. I think you get it on lots of websites in the UK.
Okay.
I don't know if it's in the United States or not. I don't think it's gotten here. I'm not sure. Okay. After Hours. Who would like to give us a little bit of a rundown on what After Hours is about? Because it's a wacky one.
It is. It is a wild movie. You know, the tagline really should be, you know, what is that? Nothing good ever happens after 2 a.m. or something like that.
Right. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. Yes. Nothing actually good ever happens after leaving work.
Yeah, pretty much. No, yeah. No.
I just have to sleep.
So the plot summary. In a Manhattan cafe, word processor Paul Hackett, played by Griffin Dunn, meets and talks literature with Marcy, played by Rosanna Arquette.
My favorite Arquette.
Your favorite Arquette?
It's my favorite Arquette. Sorry. Oh. I had to add that.
Okay. That's okay. I like Patricia.
I like Rosanna.
Patricia's pretty good. I mean, she's still going.
She's still going. Yeah.
Rosanna kind of dropped off
the
face of the movies. Yep. So later that night, Paul takes a cab to Marcy's downtown apartment. His $20 bill flying out the window during the ride portends the unexpected night he has. He cannot pay for the ride and finds himself in a series of awkward, surreal, and life-threatening situations with a colorful cast of characters. He spends the rest of the night trying to return uptown. It's a little wacky.
Is this based on a book?
I think it's an original screenplay.
Is it? Wow.
I believe it's an original screenplay. The writer is Joseph Minion, and again, directed by Martin Scorsese. I have to say they assembled quite the cast.
Especially the female cast.
The female cast? Or cask.
Cast.
Yes.
Cast. You have whiskey on the brain. So it says in the trivia that Joseph Minion's script was his thesis for Columbia Film School. Huh. He got an A from his teacher, Yugoslavian director Dusan Makaveyev.
Oh, big fan of his. Big fan.
Sure. Big fan.
Big fan.
Okay.
Oh, that was it.
Oh, that was it.
Big fan.
No, I was
just a big fan.
It was kind of a joke. I'm not a big fan. I don't know who he is.
Just a big fan.
He sort of killed it.
I thought you were running into like a rundown of stuff he's done.
I have no idea who he is. It's not like an obscure name from Wikipedia.
Well, no, he's a Columbia Film School teacher.
Okay.
I mean, you know, who knows? Anyway.
So odd screenplay written by this guy. And boy, you have to kind of a weird sense of humor to be putting this thing together, right? It feels like a creative writing class thing that you would have done. Not you, maybe, but someone could do. And say,
you
hey,
would.
I would.
I've seen your writing. You yeah. would, yeah.
Yeah, that, yeah, maybe yeah. I would do that. And then, you get lucky and you get it turned into a film.
It also seems like an odd thing to be associated with Scorsese.
So the Scorsese part for me was like, this doesn't even compute.
He's not, you know, a quirky kind of, you know, that kind of
well,
stuff.
Well, that's not true.
This is almost like Favreau kind of thing.
But that's not necessarily so, though. I mean, Kings of Comedy? Come on. That was pretty off the wall, that one.
That was later, I think. Yeah. Well,
no, that was before this.
That was before.
Oh, was it really? Oh,
yeah. Kings of Comedy was before this. Yeah. So apparently, the story with this one is he was having his passion project was The Last Temptation of Christ. That's what he was trying to get made, and he was having a hard time with that. I think getting either getting the funding or getting it together. So this thing kind of landed on his lap, and he's like, "All right, I'll do this." Tim Burton was actually the second choice of director.
Whoa.
He must have been young doing it then, Burton.
This is 85 was the movie.
Yeah. So it says here, Tim Burton was the second choice for director after the producers saw Vincent in 1982. So I guess he made a movie called Vincent in 1982.
No.
When Scorsese became available after production delays on The Last Temptation of Christ, Burton, according to Griffin Dunn, gracefully bowed out of the project, saying he didn't want to stand in the way of Scorsese, which is probably a smart move.
Scorsese is the button guy.
He knows a guy. He knows a few guys.
He knows some guys.
We really think you'd like to step aside.
Yeah, it was definitely a quirky movie. I have to say one thing, though. I forgot how stacked the cast is in this thing.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing. Yeah,
it is a crazy cast.
Well, when we start there, let's talk cast. It is so, I mean, we can run down the name. Griffin Dunn alone, we start there. It's pretty good, right? And Roseanne Arquette is as the first lead female in it. Followed by Linda Fiorentino, Terry Garr. I mean, that's a trifecta of the era. And then Catherine O'Hara.
And then at the very end, he runs into Verna Bloom.
And Verna Bloom, that's right.
And it was bothering me while I'm watching, like Verna Bloom. And then she was in Animal House.
Yeah,
she was. His name? Wormer's
the dean's wife.
Dean Wormer's wife. Yeah.
And she's great in this. And
she was very good.
Yes.
She was really, really good.
Well, any other name? Bronson Pinchot's in it.
Bronson Pinchot's his little cameo. Cheech and Chong,
right?
Will Patton.
John Hurd John Hurd is the bartender. Right. It's a good cast.
And it was a little thing that, later John Hurd and Catherine O'Hara are, you know, the mother, the mom in what's it called?
Were they in a movie together? I didn't know.
Home Alone, maybe?
No, never heard of it. Is that a domestic bliss movie?
What
is that about?
Just a little one.
Wonder what the lineage is from this movie, because maybe that's the first time they've worked together in this movie. Mm-hmm. Maybe they didn't work together too much, but then to Home Alone. Wonder how that happens. Martin Scorsese wanted to direct Home Alone.
Yeah, but you know what? If he would have directed Home Alone.
Oh, my God. It would have been amazing.
And it was as big of a hit as it was. How many projects would that have funded for him?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, true.
You know what I mean? So, right. Although Goodfellas was a pretty big hit for him.
Yeah.
If he directed it, Pesci would have killed the kid.
Well, see, that would have been a better movie.
No, better the movie. Kid would have killed Pesci.
Would have been a hail of bullets.
The kid would have killed Pesci.
Would have been a hail of bullets.
That's what would have happened.
That would have been good.
Somebody wound up in a trunk.
There wouldn't have been feathers. There wouldn't have been hot tar. It
definitely fit the kid in the trunk.
It would have just been a gun. Double tap in the basement. When he's going down the steps.
So it's a great cast. There's just so many people in here who, you know, some of them are just kind of role B-listers maybe a little bit. And they've all had their little highs and lows in their, you know, in the last 30 years. Catherine O'Hara is riding a high at the moment. And all the other ones have had their moments or little minor eras but they're not, no one in there is probably, I don't know, maybe Roseanne Arquette, maybe Griffin Dunn are true like A-listers, I guess, over the full stretch of their career.
Yeah, not yet. Well, at least not Roseanne Arquette yet.
At that time. No, I meant over their career.
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, looking back, you don't look at that and go, well, of course that movie was great. Look at the cast.
Yeah, but at the time, right?
Well, I remember watching this. I think I saw it on VHS way back in the day at home. I guess I saw it a couple years after it came out, like 87. And I didn't know much about it. I just kind of grabbed it. And I'm watching, I'm like, you know, and I knew a little bit about Scorsese because I was just starting to become like a big fan at the time. And I'm like, you know, this feels like a Scorsese movie just because of the camera movement and the way it was shot and all this crazy stuff. It felt like a Scorsese movie. Then I'm like, oh, well, what do you know? It is a Scorsese movie.
So, and I don't know Scorsese like you guys do, but it feels like his, aside from the quirkiness, the grittiness of the city,
yeah,
I think he does really well.
Right.
The city being New York. And right. He does that so great.
Wow, he grew up down there.
You can feel the potholes. You can feel the rain. You can feel the trash. You can feel the homeless people. You can feel them all in your face from the get-go. You know,
and this is right around when Soho was starting to really build up.
Yeah, that's true.
Still, it wasn't what it is now yet. I mean, it was still, you know, artists living there and just for cheap rent and big spaces. You know, for studios.
Yeah.
I don't think it was quite there. Like right now, it's probably crazy. Millions of dollars for a loft in Soho.
I kept thinking about telephones in this movie. And,
yeah. Oh, with the dial.
Well, just telephones in general. How if you put this movie today, made this movie today, and everyone had cell phones, it would be a short film. Everything gets solved very quickly.
But that's every movie, right?
He would have called Uber. He never lost his 20.
Right. He could use his iPhone to pay. Right?
Yeah, Uber would have taken him home.
Yeah, it would be very simple. The movie would be over in about 12 minutes. But no, no one has a phone, and I have to run to find a phone, to have a quarter for the phone, for a pay phone. No one's got a phone you can use, and it's a mess.
I also like just the opening scene where it's the drudgery of word processing.
I'm a word processor.
When he walks out, they close the gates.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, where you're like that job still exists today. There's the guards to close the gates. Those gates are just gone. Yes. There's no gates.
No gates. But there's a badge that you have to, you know, wand.
Yeah. You got to wand your badge through.
Yeah. It was a different era, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The phone thing was just funny. When she, was this Terry Garr? It was Terry Garr trying to give Griffin Dunn her phone number? I think it was her, and she just said 5 digits.
Oh, with the KL.
The Klondike 5. She didn't say the Klondike part. She just did the other five numbers.
And he's like, okay, five numbers.
We're missing some numbers here.
Well, now it would have to be 10 numbers, right?
Right, with area codes.
There's how many different area codes in New York.
Yeah.
They're not all 212.
No.
And then he's trying to get the number, and Catherine Harris sits next to him and starts yelling numbers out. Where
Seven.
Now you'd be like, well, it's in my phone. I just push a button.
Yes. Nobody's writing stuff down and remembering numbers anymore. Of course
not. Absolutely
not. No. That's a lot of, that's comparing today and then, but it's funny looking at it, at that stuff. It was the way we lived. It's the way we lived then. And the whole cab thing was funny. And the cab driver is just mean and rolling really fast.
He's being around the back of the cab like
it's gonna fly
getting away from some criminal activity.
Who puts the 20 in the ashtray? Why would you do that?
I don't know. Why would you just
have the sharpest tool in the shed?
No, close the windows. I mean,
he's a little sleazy too, isn't he?
Griffin Dunn.
A little.
Yeah,
he
makes some interesting decisions that night, doesn't he?
He makes some very poor decisions all night long.
Yes, he does. Ripping the 20 off of the paper mache at the end was...
That was hysterical. That was so funny.
Yes.
That was so funny.
Our friend Griffin Dunn gets out, tries to get home, and how does he end up meeting Marcy?
He meets her at the coffee shop, right? He just goes out, he's reading, what is it, Tropic of Cancer?
She starts the conversation.
Right.
So he's getting picked up on. This is like, woo, this is going to be a good day. And then what?
He's on his way home and decides she seems a little weird. I'm going to go home. And then, to your point, nothing good happens after a certain point in time. He decides, I'm going to venture back out.
Yes.
And when he goes back out, that's when everything goes off the rails. And you made a comment that Griffin Dunn's character was a little Gene Wilder-esque.
He was very Gene Wilder-esque. And it bothered me the whole time when I was watching it the other day.
What do you
mean? Like his voice... And the way he would get like exasperated, you know how like where he's dancing with Verna Bloom, and he's like, "I just want to live, I just want to live," and that just reminded me of what's it called so much, Young Frankenstein.
Yeah,
you know, I just felt like that, or like when he's in the, you know, it's pouring rain and he's kneeling down in the middle of the street. I just want to go home. I thought he was very Gene Wilder-esque, and I could see Gene Wilder playing this in a, you know, in an alternate universe.
And it was almost like everything happened around him.
Yeah.
Like almost a victim of circumstance, which is similar to some of the Gene Wilder things, the madcap kind of stuff that happens.
It's funny you say this. I don't remember that so much, but there seems to be a bit of an, thinking back, an affectation to his mannerisms and voice a bit in the movie. I never thought of Gene Wilder, but I could see it. Was Griffin Dunne on Broadway? Did he do musicals?
Maybe.
I don't know either. Interesting.
If you watch it again, just certain scenes, it just felt like, again, like Wilder, like in The Producers, when he's like at the end of his rope, or when he's in, you know, Young Frankenstein, and again, he's at the end of his rope. Frankenstein, you know, he's freaking out. He gave off a Gene Wilder vibe to me. So not a bad thing. Gene Wilder's great.
No, not a bad thing.
That's a pretty big compliment.
Yeah, he was really good. I mean, I think I could see other people doing this role.
Yeah, I mean, Matthew Broderick could have been Matthew the freshman. Broderick, it's a similar kind of thing like in The Freshman.
Have you ever been to Palermo, Sicily? I also found it interesting, all the odd jobs that the women characters had. That the one's a poet, the one's a sculptor, the one is, you know, the waitress, the one drives an ice cream truck.
The ice cream truck, yeah.
Where you're just so like, what kind of jobs are these?
It's the gig economy. It's the pre-gig economy.
And they did the great callback where the one woman who's the waitress, she says, I also work in a...
The Xerox shop.
At a Xerox shop.
Yeah.
And then later on, you see her Xeroxing. Now, you don't see her Xerox. You see the product as she's posting his picture on every telephone pole. There is. You're like, oh, that's the callback. How is she able to do that? Oh, wait, she works at a Xerox shop.
I like the neighborhood mob that gets together to go hunt him down.
Yes.
You know, today would be, you know, getting on Nextdoor and creating this huge to-do on Nextdoor. Hey, there's a guy in my neighborhood. What do you think I should do? And there'll be, you know, a social media explosion. A blitz on and trying to find this guy's poor Griffin Dunne's picture would have been all over.
He'd be ruined 3 seconds, for life.
Totally canceled, right?
I think it holds up, though. I mean, except for like the technology stuff, but you could say that about any movie.
Sure.
I think it holds up pretty well.
Yeah, I do too. The humor's really timeless. It's very funny. It's looking at odd people for a short amount of time and a lot of stress going on in their lives and how you deal with it and how you and how the filmmaker Scorsese finds humor and in it all and by putting him in these odd situations. I think it's done really well. It's still pretty quirky.
Oh, it's very quirky.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that, like Cheech and Chong are in it. They're hysterical.
So weird. Is this before Up in Smoke or after Up in Smoke?
I have no idea. It's Up in Smoke adjacent.
Adjacent.
I still can't get over the cast, though. The cast just blew me away.
Did you not remember the cast?
I did, but it's just like, you know, you're away from a movie for like 30 years and you go back and it's like, oh, yeah, that's
great. Yeah. And you see them all like lined up one after the other, scene after scene, and you go, wow, it was just
really, really funny.
Yeah.
And I like the little cameos, like when he first meets Rosanna Arquette in the coffee shop, Scorsese's mom and dad are the older couple at the table, just kind of chatting away. And
Scorsese himself.
Right. And Club Berlin with the spotlight, you know, kind of doing his thing. So it was just cool.
He's like, what's the Marvel guy? The man.
Stan Lee.
Puts himself in all these movies.
He's like Stan Lee.
Right. Well, I enjoyed it. I would definitely recommend. I actually have recommended this to a few people since we rewatched it. And it's really good. It holds up. It's fun.
There's a lot of Scorsese stuff on HBO Max. Because I was just like combing through and we were trying to figure out what movies to do. I'm like, oh, After Hours. That would be fun. I think I gave you guys a list of like 5 or 6 movies.
Yeah, it's a good one. So, it's a real good one.
So you know what's neat too? I think it's on there. There's the documentary he made with his parents back in the early 70s.
Yeah.
Italian-American.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen it?
I did see it.
It's really short. It's like 40 minutes. It's really good. His parents are great. And his parents remind me of a friend of mine's parents. Like his mom looked like her mom.
Yeah.
His dad looked a little bit like him, but just first generation Italian, that whole thing. You know,
How old is Scorsese?
That demeanor. He's got to be in his 80s at this point. He's got to be late 70s, early 80s.
He's 80. Born in 42.
He's 80 now? Wow. He's working hard, man.
He doesn't stop.
No. Him, like, he's like Eastwood. He's going to crank this stuff out till he's going to keep doing it till he's done.
Well, and he's got his Mercury Theater. He does everything with De Niro and Pesci and all these other guys he trots out.
DiCaprio, that's his new De Niro.
Come back again.
Yeah, why not? Why would you not want to work with him?
Yeah.
You know?
He definitely has a little troupe that he works with, that's for sure.
They all do, though. I mean, you know, but you know, like they said before, why wouldn't you want to work with your friends? I think we had this discussion before.
You get a chance, you make it big, you hire all your friends.
Yeah. Right. Right. Why the hell not? You all get along. You could all do different things. Sure. Why the hell not?
I used to love in the early 80s when cable TV, and I think I might have saw this on cable TV actually at some point, but when those guys like Coppola and Scorsese are starting out kind of earlier in their career, and you find these small movies of theirs. I'm trying to think of one that I thought Rosanna Arquette was in of Coppola's out in the deserts. I don't remember what it was called. And those were just, it's like before they got totally massive, right? And they're doing these massive, I don't want to say blockbusters, but bigger films. And they're really kind of just starting out and they're really just trying to find themselves as filmmakers. And I think this is one of those.
Well, they were all friends. I mean,
and they're all, they're all friends. That's true.
De Palma, Scorsese, Coppola, Spielberg.
Yep.
John Milius, George Lucas.
They were all buddies.
They were the film school kids.
They were. Yeah.
Because they were like the first directors to go to film school.
And now they're all 80s, and they're close to 80, if not 80.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they started it, right? They were like they were the height of the 70s.
Yep.
All those guys.
Yeah. So I think this was really great to rewatch. I really enjoyed it. It was a great choice.
Want to go back to the whiskey for a little bit, and then we can go back to the movie?
Like the whiskey.
Yeah. I'm going to go for round two on the whiskey.
This was the El Sabe Sweet Smoke Release 1.2. By the way, did you mention this? It was 48.9.
Yep, 48.9. Almost a five. Almost a whiskey with a five.
We can round up.
Sure. It's a rounding error. It's really, really nice. I like it. It's really, really fun. And it's different for something from William Grant & Son, because they don't really do peaty.
Nope.
Except for like the peat beak Balvenie stuff.
Oh, by the way, I looked up Brian Kinsman earlier.
Wasn't he with Glenfiddich for a while or not?
Yes, he, let's see, he's crafted some of the most exciting whiskeys in the company's history, including reimagining of Grant's and creating Monkey Shoulder.
Oh, okay.
Elsa Bay, Glenfiddich Grand Cru, a 23-year-old single malt aged in American and European oak. And finished off in rare French cuvée casks. So yes, he has a bit of history in the Glenn Grant world. So and he started training under Mr. David Stewart. So at
the, okay.
Yeah.
The legend.
The legend, right.
Legendary so, Dave Stewart.
I haven't had much of this bottle. Hmm. I think I've shared it with a couple people.
I think you're going to go back to it now. You're going to be like, oh, wait, this is damn good.
The second sip reminds me of when I had it the first time, when I did open the bottle. That first hit was pretty hard.
Yeah, but now you go back and it's like, oh,
now it's beautiful. Yeah. I mean, it's delicious. Really delicious. It's
really, really good.
And
Mike, what do you think? Is this about your level of smoke? Although you can handle more.
I find sometimes the smoke is almost like a dare where, you know, you've peated it to the point where it's like all you're getting is ash.
You say that like it's a bad thing.
Exactly. Where my flavor profile is not burned down house. where I think this has really good balance. It really does.
It's really nice. And that was the whole point, right?
And I think it lends itself more to the barbecue than it does to the wood fire, which I prefer.
Yeah. I really like the thought, the concept, the idea of putting a sweetness level and the smokiness level on the bottle. Aside from the wine finishes, when we think of scotch in general, I think of those two things, the smokiness, because you always hear it's smoky, I'm not going to drink scotch. And there's a lot of course, we know there's not a lot of smoke in a lot of single malts or scotch. And the sweetness, those are the two big flavor profiles in a lot of scotch. And I like having, I don't know what the measurement means. I know what it meant. I know what it sort of means on the smoke side, but it's kind of fun. It'd be kind of fun for the industry to kind of measure those things. It can't be hard.
And when they're almost the same, I wonder if you get something like this.
Mm-hmm.
where it's a really good balance. Yeah. Where if they're out of whack, if it was like 40 to 20, it'd be so heavily smoked, then maybe you wouldn't want it.
Yeah.
It wouldn't. Well, maybe you'd still want it, but it wouldn't be like this. Wouldn't have the balance.
I liked it. Delicious. And I'm happy to share with you guys.
It's really good. It's really different.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, I mean, finito. Gone.
Oh, gonzo. Gonzo.
Yeah, mine evaporated.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, is that the angel share? Is that
the angel share?
Devil's cut. Which one is it?
It's really hot here.
The angel share. Elsa Bay Sweet Smoke Release 1.2 paired nicely, very nicely with Martin Scorsese's 1985 hit. Was it a hit? I don't even know if it was a hit or not.
Well, I don't know. It says here the budget was 4.5. The gross box office was 10.6. It gets an IMDb score of 7.6 out of 10, 91% on Rotten Tomatoes.
91%. That's awesome.
And a 90 Metascore.
Okay.
It sounds like a hit to me.
That's a hit.
Yeah.
A minor hit.
Put these guys on the map.
Do we have any good quotes here?
Oh, I think we had a bunch of those, didn't we?
There were a few. But you know what was interesting, too, going back to the cast? I really like Linda Fiorentino.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't seen her in many things. But I thought she was great in this. Did you ever see a movie called Gotcha?
Yeah.
It was with her and Anthony Edwards. He's in Europe. He's traveling like after post-college.
He's like in Europe. Like a school trip kind of thing.
And she like scams him. She pretends she's like some Eastern European woman. And they wind up playing, I don't know what the hell it was, some kind of cat and mouse game all through Europe. I mean, I haven't seen this movie in like 35 years, but she was really good in that. I liked her in this. Did you ever see The Last Seduction?
No.
That's probably mid-90s, late-90s. It's sort of a film noirish kind of movie.
Men in Black is her big one.
Oh, she was great in Men in Black.
And like she's in Jade, which is, you know, and it's a real film noir kind of thing.
I did not see Jade. Jade's
really good. It's Caruso and Chaz Palminteri. It's really good.
Okay. And she's a South Philly girl. And she went to Goretti.
I didn't know she was from Goretti.
She went to Goretti. She's a gorilla.
You're not supposed to say that. It makes them angry.
Exactly. That's the whole point, isn't it?
It'll make the gorillas angry.
Is it Goretti Gorilla?
Oh, she was in Dogma.
Was she?
Yeah. She's the lead.
I didn't like that movie.
Well, you know, you gotta take what's his name up for what it's worth.
Kevin Smith.
Smith, yeah.
Oh, yeah. She has some great lines with Rickman when they're going around together.
Oh, Alan Rickman, yeah.
I try to forget that movie. It was a bit much. I didn't care for that one. I did not care.
God play skee ball.
So let's see. A little trivia. Scorsese designed the film as a parody of Hitchcock's style. The elaborate camera movements echo sequences in Marnie, while Howard Shore's score emulates the style of one of Hitchcock's most frequent collaborators, Bernard Herrmann. Oh, here's a funny one. Julie Terrigar has an entire shelf of Aquanet in her apartment.
I noticed that, yes.
I was hysterical. I just kept looking at it. I'm like, when's it going to come up?
Pink, 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 pink. Yeah.
Oh, it was great. And when his hand gets stuck in her hair.
Do you want to touch it? No.
It's no, not really.
Miss Buffon hairdo, 1965 or something.
That's what That was so good. Then was the whole story that what's her name tells him about the Wizard of Oz. The guy she was seeing, surrender Dorothy, surrender Dorothy. There was all this weird stuff.
And it sort of doesn't go anywhere, that story, right?
And then they kind of tie it in with him talking about the, what did he do? He got his tonsils out and he winds up in the burn ward of a hospital.
Yes.
And they have him with the, what's it called?
So that's Scorsese, right? That's a Scorsese little story there.
It was just funny how it just kind of all comes together. It was just fun. Oh, when he's the thing I was saying where I thought he sounded like Gene Wilder. It's like Paul Hackett on his knee, Paul Hackett, the character that Griffin Dunne's playing, on his knees, screaming to the heavens, "What do you want from me? What have I done? I'm just a word processor, for Christ's sake."
I love that line.
It's just funny. It's funny.
The whole office look and the term word processor as a job.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, that is so funny.
Yeah, well, I mean, I remember before I started at my place, they said they used to have a whole data processing.
Yeah.
Data processing.
Yeah. Well, I'm about data, it was word processing.
It was.
Like when they would do like the annual reports
yeah.
and they do yeah. the budget and all that kind of stuff.
Electronic typewriter. with an electronic word processing machine from the Brother Corporation.
So the guy I work for, who I've worked for the last 30 years, he started there probably like 84, 85, where they still had that before everybody had their computers.
Yeah.
You know, before you had a word computer, before you had like all that stuff. So he said, you know, they would have the typewriter crew typing everything up, and they would proofread everything.
Yeah.
And now when you hand this guy like 30 pages of documents, let's say I hand him a 30-page report or something like that. I don't do those anymore. But when I did, the guy would find a mistake on page 7. It was unbelievable. Like his proofreading skills are like ridiculous. Oh my God. You almost want to like put him in there to see if he catches it. You missed one, pal. You missed one.
Tractor feed printer paper. Rip off the edges.
That was kind of funny when what's his name telling him his dream, Bronson Pinchot. How he wants to like start up. He wants to start. And it sounded almost like when I'm watching it, I was thinking of Succession.
Yes.
With the whole thing, the 100.
Yeah.
You know, he wants to get a group of writers and he just wants to publish them and, you know, put it all together in one big magazine. I'm like, oh my God, it's the 100.
And Griffin Dunn's not paying attention at all.
No, not at all. He's looking at the paper and he's like, Jesus Christ, what am I doing for a living? Any other tidbits from the film?
I just like the very end.
Why? Because it was over?
No. When he falls out of the thing.
Oh, yeah, he winds up at work.
And it breaks the mold, and then there's the gates opening, and he's right back at the
port. It's amazing. It's great.
Right back again.
Yes. It's a perfect closure to the whole story.
Yeah.
You know, it's where it started. It's perfect. And it just goes right back into work. Whatever.
Do you remember going to clubs like Club Berlin?
No.
Never? Like an after-hours club or anything like that?
Oh, I remember going to after-hours clubs, but nothing like that. That's pretty industrial, weird.
I wasn't stuff. Like that for me. But there was one, what was it called? There was a club in Old City and it was after hours. So we would go like after like 2 a.m. and it was just so bizarre. I can't remember the name of it, but it was an old bank. It was like an old church. It was like an old Greek church and they converted it to a club, but it was, you know, you have to wait to get in and you got to wait in line.
I know somebody. Kind of,
and I'd never gone clubbing in New York. I think I went once. We went to a club and it was like, you know, and you get there at 8 o'clock. Clubs in New York don't start till like midnight. It was like, there's like nobody here.
It always seems scary to me.
Yeah, I hear you.
You don't know what's going on in there. Past the bouncer.
You have no clue.
No.
No clue whatsoever. No,
you're in the sewer system of the city.
Yeah, now, have you ever had a night like that where it just kind of just goes on and on and on and on?
Yes.
Not that crazy.
I have had nights like that, yeah.
Yes. Those like really, really long nights?
Yes. With blood and hospitals and driving and yes, I have had those. Yes.
Have you?
Long ago.
I didn't have the blood in the hospitals, but it was always, you know, the bars, then we maybe go to an after hours club, then we go hit like the diner at 4 o'clock in the morning, then you roll it home.
Yes.
6 o'clock. Yes. You know.
My life is part of my life is some small percentage of my life is spent at Denny's. After 2 in the morning, you can measure it a little bit. Yes. Having a Grand Slam breakfast at 2:45 in Hollywood at a Denny's. Yeah.
No, Oregon Diner. And we all had our regulars, you know, it was always like, you know, a grilled cheese and tomato, cup of coffee. Somebody else would get like waffles and ice cream. Another friend would get like the French onion soup. I'm like, what are we doing? 2 o'clock in the morning.
Little Pete's. Little Pete's was great.
Or a bar on like 56th Street trying to get a Guinness on a Thursday night at 3 a.m. We did that after a Jubilee.
In the 80s, when did bars close in New York? When do they close now?
4 a.m., don't they? They used to close at like 4, didn't they?
They close it here.
Philly was 2 a.m.
I think it's 1 or I think it's 1 o'clock here.
Philly used to be 2 a.m., but I think up there they close at like 3 or 4.
Wow.
I think. It's a city that never sleeps.
That's right. Maybe it should. Maybe it should. All right, boys. This was good. This was After Hours, 85, classic, strange little comedy, and a kind of cute little bottle from Scotland called Ailsa Bay. We did well again on One Show, One Drink. Just a fun little evening here, guys.
Yes, 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 yes.
Thanks for sharing.
Should we take it out? Till next time?
Yeah, let's take it out. Yep. All right, gents.
Let's hit the city.
What?
Let's hit the city.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. I got $20. I have a $20 bill burning a hole in my pants.
I'm in. I think I got some money in Apple Pay. I'll Venmo you.
I don't know what that is.
You don't know Venmo? Come on, man. Zelly? How about Zella?
Isn't this 1985?
I don't know, man. I don't know. I work on cash only. All right, folks.
Cheers.
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 If you enjoy this show, please subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, Google, Audible, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. You can also find us on boozedancing.com. And if you have any questions, comments, show, or drink suggestions, email us at boozedancing@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.